This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us. It's time for Trumpet Hour. We have our panel of writers for the Trumpet eager and ready to discuss the important events of this past week. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Thanks for having me.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
Via Skype from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And via Skype from Jerusalem, we have Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
Since the nuclear deal that went into effect last year, the world has come to embrace Iran as a partner among nations, which is pretty amazing given Iran's history of sponsoring terrorism, its contribution to unrest all over the Middle East and beyond, its threats to wipe Israel off the map, its repeated violations of United Nations resolutions. But these are not just past activities. Iran is still doing these things, and quite openly. Beginning this past Tuesday, Iran hosted the International Conference in Support of the Palestinian Intifada. And this really gives you a pretty good idea of where Iran is on these kinds of issues today. To learn about this, we're going to turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
So it's pretty important to remember just how much the Iranian regime does not like Israel. And people can we know that and that the cliches of wiping Israel off the map tend to not really register when we see them so often. And yet this is a nation that has 80 million people, millions more Shiites around the Middle East that listen to the Iranian leader. And what it seemed and what we could see from that is that even though they are such a large country, they aren't moderated at all in their views, and they are allowed by the international community to say such wretched and horrible things about another nation in the 21st century, and they very much just get away with it. And just this past week, as you said, they had this conference. This is the sixth time that it's been held. It's been held since the early 90s, and it's held every few years. Iran holds it, and it's supporting not a Palestinian state or a peace deal between the Israelis and the Palestinians. It's a conference that brings in hundreds of delegates throughout the Middle East to Iran to lend their support for the Palestinian Intifada. That means they want to support a violent overthrowing of the Israeli state. That's what they're doing there. They're not there for peace. They are there so that they can say death to Israel. And they really do believe it.
Right. So I guess the thing is, like you said at the beginning, we're used to hearing this coming out of Iran. And so a lot of people probably just look at it as, well, you know, it's just talk, basically. But you're taking a look here at, okay, well, let's just listen to the talk and let's take it for what it is. Maybe you could just give us some insight into what went on at this conference.
Right. So there are numerous speakers. President Hassan Rouhani, the moderate, he was speaking at the Death to Israel summit. Also, Ali Larijani, he's the Speaker of the House of Parliament, the third probably most powerful man in Iran. He's there as well as the Ayatollah. And they each gave speeches, but I chose just to dissect the Ayatollah's speech himself, the leader of Iran. And I'll just go through a couple of excerpts, if you like, from his speech. The speech is fully translated on his website. He's not ashamed of any of this type of speech. He's not trying to hide it from the world. It's been translated on his website into English. He wants the world to know this is what he thinks. Mm-hmm. And this is really what he thinks. This isn't bluster. Anyway, he starts out talking about, quote, he says, "The history of Palestine is full of ups and downs, marked by the cruel occupation of that region, the rendering of millions of individuals homeless, and the courageous resistance of those heroic people." And then he says, "An intelligent quest in history shows that no people in any era of history have ever been subjugated to such pain, suffering, and cruelty."
Okay.
So this is the leader of Iran talking to his people, and he's basically saying a lie. I mean, no other people in history have been subjected to such cruelty as the Palestinians. Well, you could just, as I write in this article on the website, just take the Jews, the subject of this speech, really. And, you know, 70 years ago, 6 million of them were put to death, exterminated. That hasn't happened to the Palestinians. Far from it. You come to Israel and you see how the Palestinians live, and it doesn't match. It doesn't match to the words that Khamenei was saying. But more things, but what he was bringing out, we'll get to some of the hatred towards Israel in a second. But I think one of the interesting points that he brought out was that for the moment, he was kind of lamenting how we've got all this turmoil through the Middle East, civil war, civil strife, and how that has undermined the Middle East nation's focus on Jerusalem, on Palestine, and how that really does need to be the unifying force throughout the Middle East to bring everyone together once again. I thought that was just a really interesting point that he made.
Yeah, the focus on Jerusalem is something that Trumpet readers won't be surprised by. We've been talking about basically Jerusalem being the jewel in Iran's plan to dominate the Middle East for decades.
It's certainly something we've drawn attention to, and now it's quite interesting because he's talking about how that now that it looks like some of these civil wars are coming to an end, it's time for everybody to refocus around Jerusalem, and that means supporting a violent intifada. He says it doesn't matter which group we support, Tehran or Iran is going to support any group that violently tries to overthrow the Jews from Jerusalem, whether it's Hamas, Fatah, whatever, we'll support them. And then he says this, zinger, he says, from the beginning, this cancerous tumor, speaking of Israel, has been developing in several phases until it turned into the current disaster. The cure for this tumor should be developed in phases as well. Until today, several intifadas and a constant and continuous resistance have managed to achieve very important phased goals. And then he talks about how the Palestinian intifada will continue to achieve the goal, its goals, until the complete liberation of Palestine. That's what he wants. That's what he wants. Violent overthrow of the Jews everywhere in the land of Israel. And he's willing to support that. And as late, it looks like Iran is supporting Hamas once again with more money, weapons, to try and motivate them to try and take Jerusalem.
So I would encourage listeners to, you can look on thetrumpet.com. And Brent has this article up there called Iran Won't Stop Till It Reaches Jerusalem. We also have our booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy, that shows why this is an area that we just really have to keep a close eye on. And I think this is a great story that you've got here, Brent, because it is easy for this to kind of drop off of our radar screen. And we've been focusing on Palestinian politics independently. And there's obviously quite a lot going on that front. But just knowing how important this is to Iran, listening to these statements from Iran's supreme leader, the fact that he has not taken his eyes off of the real prize for Iran, it's really important for us to keep this in our memories. Thank you, Brent. Another very aggressive power that seems to get a pass for a lot of bad behavior is Russia. Quite an amazing story this week about Russia's belligerent, even murderous effort to influence events in a European nation in order to advance its own interests. If you still think that getting along with Vladimir Putin's Russia is the way to go, here's more evidence to show what you're really dealing with here. For this story, we're going to go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this story, it actually happened in October of last year, but no one really believed it until it was confirmed this week by some of the world's most widely respected intelligence agencies. But the basics of the plot are that two Russian intelligence officers spent months in the Balkan nation of Montenegro. They were there recruiting and equipping a small force of Serbian nationalists. And the plan was that on October 16th, the day that Montenegro was to hold its parliamentary elections, this team was going to attack the Montenegrin parliament building. The attackers would be disguised as police officers, and they would open fire on a crowd just as the election results were announced. And then in the resulting confusion, some other team members in the conspiracy would force their way into the parliament building and assassinate the prime minister. So, I mean, even by standards of Balkan intrigue, this is a really surreal plot. Yeah. And it's if it had been pulled off successfully, it very likely would have tipped Montenegro into a civil war. It would have almost certainly derailed Montenegro's hopes of joining NATO, which it's scheduled to do this summer, and of joining the EU, which is supposed to happen in the early 2020s.
And that's really the issue, isn't it?
Yes, that's exactly right. Russia views NATO as this power that's just bent on, you know, curtailing Russian power and containing Russia. So they want to do everything they can to prevent NATO from growing. But of course, the plot was not successfully carried out. One of the conspirators got cold feet and he went to the police. And so just a few hours before it was supposed to go down, the police arrested about 20 people in connection with this plot. So it never happened. As you would expect, the Russians deny that they were involved. And for the most part, up until this week, people kind of believed that. They believed, yeah, this is, it's hard to say whether the Russians actually were involved. But this week, the Telegraph reported that intelligence officials had confirmed these reports, including the part about high-level Russian involvement. Senior officials in NATO and in the American and British intelligence communities all said that the foiled plot was genuine and that it was directed by Russian intelligence officers with backing from Moscow. And as we said, you can really see why Russia would have motives to do this, both because of the NATO aspect and the EU aspect, but also specifically if you look at the Balkan Peninsula. The Russians have always felt enraged by the way Germany and America dismantled the Balkan Peninsula in a way that really served German interests and boosted German power. Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has written extensively on everything that happened there in the Balkans in the 1990s and the 2000s and the way that infuriated Vladimir Putin's Russia.
And he even talked about just how much that the statements that Vladimir Putin made where he was calling Germany out on that, I guess that was, what, a year and a half ago?
That's exactly right, yes. When people started to decry Putin's annexation of Ukraine's Crimea Peninsula, he cited Yugoslavia and the Balkans War as precedent for that. Mm-hmm. He said, what we are doing here is no different than what NATO, Germany, and America basically carried out there. So this assassination plot really is interesting in that context. And even though it failed, the very fact that it was planned, I think, shows that Moscow has not entirely conceded victory to Germany over the entirety of the Balkans Peninsula. And I think it shows just that Russia is more determined than ever to prevent further NATO expansion.
What are your thoughts, Richard? We were just talking on the program on Wednesday about just how there's this alignment of interest between Germany and Russia on a few peripheral issues, but it seems like what you're looking at here is evidence of those more underlying hostilities that would pretty well always be there.
Yes, and you do have to wonder how much is going on behind the scenes or you know, maybe were there discussions between Russia and Germany? Was there some kind of a, you know, like, this is just an example of what we can do to really upset things in there. Because there has, over the past month or so, I think there's been a steady stream of news items coming out of the Balkans, of things like the Republika Srpska that we've talked about in parts of that's part of Bosnia and Herzegovina, and things heating up there. You've got Montenegro and that drawing closer to NATO. You've got Serbia sent a train or wanted to send a train into Kosovo with all kinds of slogans on the side saying Serbia is forever or Kosovo is forever part of Serbia that caused a major diplomatic incident. There's a lot of incidents there that indicate things are kind of heating up or at least simmering, continuing to simmer in the Balkans. And so it does seem like Russia deliberately wants to keep that alive, keep that as kind of almost a frozen conflict like it has in Ukraine and Crimea, like it has in Georgia, and just keep that kind of open and there as a pressure point, as something to say to Europe, look, well, if the chips go down completely, if it comes to all out hostility between the two of us, we've got quite a few levers over there that we could use to hurt you. So, you know, don't make us have to use them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very, very fascinating. Well, thanks for that, Jeremiah. And we'll use this kind of as a pivot to Europe. There has been a lot of news out of Europe lately. If you've watched thetrumpet.com, we're doing our best to stay on top of it all. Advancements in military unification, the beginning of new trade deals with other nations, as Stephen Fleury covered on Trumpet Daily Radio Show this morning. But there really are still serious problems facing Europe on the economic front. And we have a story about this in this week's Trumpet Weekly and up on thetrumpet.com. For this, we're going to go to our man in Britain, Richard.
That's right. We have an article titled "The Eurozone is Waiting for Another Crisis to Hit" by Kieran Underwood. And this kind of pulls together from quite a few different sources growing warnings about what's going on in Europe and what's going on in the Eurozone, because there are a whole load of analysts from a whole load of different places saying, you know, things are looking pretty bad over here. And there's just, in a lot of ways, it's not just one story. It's not like we're here saying, well, Greece is about to explode. It's that there's a lot of different places that could explode and look even potentially likely to explode over the next year or so. So you have certainly got Greece, and they've got, they need Europe to agree to release a whole load of money again. And there's that same impasse again where they want certain conditions. Europe doesn't want to give them those, and that's building. You've got Italy, and we've talked about this, where there's just this kind of political limbo here. They tried to change their election laws. It didn't work. Now, more recently, the ruling party looks like it's splitting in Italy, or one of the ruling parties. And you're seeing Eurosceptic groups emerge as the most powerful political groups within Italy, and groups that want Italy to leave the Eurozone. You're seeing the National Front rise in France, and some of their opponents of the National Front have been having some serious problems over the last few weeks, and people are getting more and more nervous that the National Front could win elections in France, and they want to pull France out of the Eurozone. You've got Geert Wilders in the Netherlands rising. We had a story on him in last week's Trumpet Weekly, and it looks like he's going to be the ruling the largest party after the elections in the Netherlands. And he wants the Netherlands out of the Eurozone. So lots of opposition building to it, lots of potential crisis points. And the thing that you've got to remember with economics is so much is about confidence. Mm-hmm. And so we don't even have to wait for one of these events to happen for potentially a crisis to trigger. You just need this lack of confidence to build. And that's what we see right now. There's a couple of concrete indicators that show that this lack of confidence is perhaps building to a crisis point. So one is how much more it costs southern European countries to borrow debt compared to Germany. Because if you think the Eurozone is basically one economic block and that everything is going to be fine, then you're going to be willing to lend Greece and Spain money at about the same interest rate that you'd be willing to lend Germany money. And that's the way it was before the euro crisis. They all had about the same rate. Well, actually, now it's starting to reach record differences. It is at various points, it's even actually you would have to pay for the privilege to give Germany money, whereas some of these other southern European countries in recent weeks, it started to shoot up how much the government has to pay. And because of a lot of the more technical mechanisms behind things, that means that they could end up insolvent, and it makes the debt burden a lot harder. And then the other practical indicator is something that's given the kind of off-putting name of Target 2 imbalances. But what this is because of the kind of half-baked nature of the Eurozone, the way it handles transactions that go between borders, what the imbalances in Target 2 are showing is that a lot of money is fleeing out of Italy, out of Greece, even out of France to a much lesser extent, but out of these southern European countries. So that shows people are losing confidence. And what it means is that Italian central banks, Greek central banks are left owing German central banks vast amounts of money. You know, we're talking now in terms of trillion, half trillion, 1.5 trillion, these types of figures, with individual central banks, hundreds of billions. And these are things that have the potential just to cause major conflicts after any country leaves the Eurozone and make it a lot of acrimony. And this is just another area that we see imbalances building. And these imbalances could even threaten Germany and force a more forceful response if a country ends up leaving. So a couple of indications there that there are real problems building.
So all of these pressures and economic pressures that you are seeing on the euro and on the eurozone, and all of these nations that are saying, well, we really are wondering whether our relations with the European Union, whether we need to stay in this. You see so many pressures on Europe right now that suggest really a dramatic restructuring, like we've been talking about for quite some time. This really is something that we could see fairly soon.
Yes, it's one of those ones that everyone knows it's coming, and just about no one knows when.
Right.
They've been very adept at patching things up and kicking the can down the road and papering over the fundamental problems. Now, what's the difference between a problem that you can paper over and a problem that you can kick the can down the road, and a problem that you can't do that anymore? It's hard to say, and it's hard to differentiate one from the other. So you can say for certainty that it's not that the current situation cannot hold, but it's very hard to predict exactly when it will break down. It could be very soon. It could take a bit longer.
We have this article by Kieran Underwood: "The Eurozone is waiting for another crisis to hit," in this week's Trumpet Weekly. And he quotes Gerald Fleury saying, "Watch closely. Germany will use this crisis to force Europe to unite more tightly. In the process, some Eurozone countries will be forced out of the Union. When that happens, the pundits will say European unification is dead, that the European Union has failed. Don't listen to them." That's a great thing to keep in mind as we're watching this happen, that really, as bad as things look, in a sense, it has to go through this crisis period in order to end up where we would expect it to, based on biblical prophecy. Well, thanks for that, Richard. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We have one more story here before we take a quick break. This time we're going to go south of the border to Mexico. There's been a lot of talk about fractured relations with the United States because of the Trump administration. But here's a story about some serious domestic problems Mexico is having to deal with. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yes, well, Mexico's murder rate has jumped by a third in the past month, up to nearly 2,000 people murdered just in the month of January alone. Now, normally Mexico and Syria kind of compete for the not very coveted position of being the world's worst humanitarian crisis. In 2015, Syria won with 55,000 people being killed in the Syrian civil war, while in Mexico, about 33,000 people were killed in drug trafficking violence.
It's an easy story to overlook. Yeah, I mean, to put it in the scale on the Syrian, in relation to the Syrian crisis, really does put it in perspective.
Yeah, so the drug violence in Mexico, it is definitely, I mean, it's worse than the violence in Iraq. It's worse than the violence in Afghanistan. It's worse than any other nation right now, except for Syria. And now that the murder rates are jumping 33% this month, if that trend holds, it may actually take first place as the world's worst humanitarian crisis in 2017. And they're saying one of the primary reasons for this is El Chapo Guzman, who's like the world's most powerful drug lord, was arrested a couple years back and recently extradited to the United States to face charges. And in his absence, the Sinaloa cartel has fractured. And so now you're getting to like a civil war between drug cartels as they try to fight for that dominant position, which is really just driving the murder rate up by so far by over 500 more people this January than last January.
So it's kind of an interesting backdrop to the whole discussion about the United States building a border wall and trying to keep a closer rein on the flood of immigrants coming from across that southern border into the United States, because there is a lot of criminal activity that really could impact the U.S. And in the meantime, I mean, we have basically something on the scale of the Syrian crisis happening right next door to us. You can't just turn the other eye to that.
Right. They estimate that there are approximately 100,000 drug cartel agents in Mexico who traffic over approximately 42 million pounds of illegal drugs every year into the United States. to distribute it here, they partner with America, has 1.4 million gang members of its own that they can partner with to get these drugs to approximately 25 million Americans, 10% of the adult population, that is using some sort of illegal drug.
Do you have a sense of just how much the United States demand for those drugs is fueling this crisis in Mexico?
Oh, probably almost exclusively. And the fact, I mean, there is 25 million drug users here. And they're moving. And of course, the gangs take their middleman cut, but it's still almost $30 billion making its way to the cartels in Mexico. Roughly, like that's be by comparison, that's like the GDP of Latvia that are going there. There's a joke going around Mexico right now that if Trump's border wall works, 30 million drug-crazed Americans foaming at the mouth and suffering withdrawals will tear it down brick by brick. Mm. And so that is really, I mean, that's what this crisis is. The root of it is it's primarily American drug users that are paying gangs, who pay cartels, who then kill each other in Mexico. Now for, and this... this spike in murders is concerning because in some ways there have been a number of high-level drug defectors who've said that, in their opinion at least, it was the policy of the Obama administration to cooperate with the Mexican government to turn a blind eye to the drug trafficking activities of the Sinaloa cartel and crack down on all the other cartels. The idea being that if you could set up Sinaloa as like this master cartel to rule them all, you could assuage America's drug addiction, but you wouldn't have this inter-cartel warfare because there's only one cartel. Now that plan has failed and the cartel's fracturing anyway, you're getting back to some of the same levels of violence we saw 10 years ago in Mexico. And it would be interesting to see... how the Trump administration's policies will change this. He's signed an executive order instructing American police to break the backs of the cartels. He's signed an executive order to try to build a wall to keep these cartels out of the United States. He gave a speech. Mr. Trump gave a speech recently saying that if he can make it more difficult for drug cartels to get drugs into America, of course, supply and demand, that will make the drugs more expensive and hopefully discourage American teenagers from getting hooked on drugs in the first place. And so that would be some positive fruits there. But it is also true that, I mean, if you have a $30 billion drug demand in the United States and you start trying to cut off supply, the cartels are going to fight back. And it is likely that violence will increase until somebody wins, either one side or the other. That's what the Mexicans found that out in 2006 when the Mexican president issued a similar order to go to war against the cartels. And about 160,000 people died in that war before Mexico just decided to give up and let the cartels do their thing again. And of course, the violence did come down when they decided to let the cartels just traffic drugs without resistance, but on the other hand, you have families destroyed and more and drug addiction rates go back up again. So you've just kicked this can down the road where now you have even more people addicted to drugs that you're going to have to deal with the criminal activity that results from that later on.
Just a shameful, shameful story. We appreciate you bringing that to us. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about growth in the German military, China pushing its client state in North Korea, punishing it, a rift between Iran and Turkey, and Canada making itself the opposite of Donald Trump in its immigration policy. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
One of the big stories we've been following out of Europe is the efforts to build a unified European military. Obviously, a European military is made up of the militaries of individual European nations, and the most important of these is Germany. Germany is building its forces up, and this week, the defense minister there announced that the nation would accelerate this increase. The headline we have in this week's Trumpet Weekly, an article from Richard Palmer titled, Germany to be a bigger military power than Russia. To learn about this, we're going to go back to Britain, to the author of the story, Richard.
Yes, I think there's two very interesting things to look at here. First is that this is a continuation of Germany's complete change of direction when it comes to its military. So in recent times, it's been shrinking its military. Last June, it hit an all-time low of around 166,000 personnel. It's only just begun turning around. So when Angela Merkel this week announced that Germany would be hiring an additional 20,000 soldiers by 2024, so that it would hit nearly 200,000 soldiers by that point, you're seeing a cementation of this complete change in direction, that Germany is no longer going to be shrinking its army. And that requires a major change in mentality, and that in itself is a big deal. Now, when you look at the specifics, at first glance, it does seem a little underwhelming in some ways. Germany had already announced that it was going to have 193,000 soldiers by 2023. So this is only an increase really of about 5,000 compared to what they had already announced. And it's something, you know, Angela Merkel reiterated at the Munich Security Conference over the weekend that Germany is only going to spend 2% of its military in 2024. There was some hope that she was going to accelerate that timetable, but she's saying, well, no, it's still kind of in the long grass 7 years away. But we quote from an article in this Trumpet Weekly called Should Europeans Spend More on Defense from the EU Observer that I think just makes a really great point. And it says, okay, well, let's just even look at this kind of quote-unquote moderate level of German defense spending. And what does the world look like if Germany is spending 2% and has a 200,000 man army? These things that at first glance can look a little underwhelming. And he says, well, actually, that gives you a Germany that's spending more on its military than Russia. That makes Germany the leading defense spender in Europe. It makes Germany the fourth largest military power in the world. It gives Germany a larger army than the UK. So this, and that's something that has real effects. And he says, well, okay, we were talking about the euro crisis. Imagine the euro crisis if Germany was this overwhelming military power. Suddenly, every move it makes has a lot more weight behind it and is a lot more menacing. They don't even need to do anything different. But just everybody knowing this is the leading power of Europe, that makes it very different. And it really cements, apparently I like that word today, but it really cements their hold on Europe as the leading power of Europe. And he goes through, well, how is this going to affect Germany's relationship with these other powers? And he makes the point, which is just a really great point, that that Europe has been this continent of peace for the last 70 years or so. But he says if land warfare between Europe's democracies has been unthinkable, this is to say that it is unthinkable primarily in a literal practical sense. There is no capacity to fight any such war, not enough men in uniform, tanks, guns or aeroplanes. But then he said, well, he goes on to say, well, could that change if you start to have Germany become a major military power? We've not seen that for the last 70 years. And as Mr. Stephen Fleury brought out on yesterday's Trumpet Daily Radio program, that's exactly the message we've been putting out here at the Trumpet and at the Plain Truth before then, that this turnaround is going to have some big effects. And this is just 2% of its military. When you look at the pressures that are building on Germany, like the euro crisis that we've been talking about, like what's going on in the Middle East, you would imagine that these announcements that are being made would only be taken much further, would only be accelerated even further. And then when you bring European unity into the mix, Europe's NATO members spend 5 times more than their defense than Russia does. So you can see how once that you get a really strong leader in Europe and in Germany, how things could change very quickly.
Well, we'll definitely keep our eyes on that. We don't have any more time to talk about it, but there is quite a lot to think about there. I would encourage you to go to thetrumpet.com, read this article, Germany to be a bigger military power than Russia. I'm sure we'll hear more about it on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show and on thetrumpet.com. Thanks for that, Richard. As we talked about a couple weeks ago, North Korea conducted an illegal ballistic missile test. The United States didn't do anything really in response, and it doesn't have a whole lot that it can do economically since it's already cut off economic relations with North Korea. But China actually did. For this story, we're going to go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, China really surprised a lot of onlookers on February 18th when it said that it would be suspending all of its coal imports from North Korea for the rest of 2017. And the very next day, that ban went into effect. And if it holds, it would be a major blow to North Korea. In recent years, coal has accounted for about 40% of North Korean exports, and just about all that has gone to China. So this ban actually has the potential to really cripple North Korea's economy. And as you said, this ban comes just a few days after North Korea conducted that major missile test, and it was an illegal test. And China's coal ban is in compliance with the United Nations, which has placed a whole range of sanctions on North Korea because of illegal weapons programs such as that most recent test. And the move by China was somewhat surprising because usually the United Nations tries to punish North Korea, but those punishments are blocked or at least hindered by China. China has veto power in the United Nations Security Council, so if Beijing wants to prevent the UN from really being able to accomplish anything, they can just use that veto sword to kind of hack through the UN's power, or they can just ignore UN sanctions, which is what they were doing by importing North Korean coal to begin with. But now, though, China is saying, yes, we will go along with the UN. We will punish North Korea for its dangerous behavior. And China would have plenty of reasons to do this. I think there is some genuine concern among the Chinese about the erratic North Korean regime of Kim Jong-un. So China may have wanted to punish the North for that February 11th missile test. China also might have wanted to send a signal to the new administration in the United States, just showing that China is willing to engage in talks on the North Korean nuclear issue. China might also have wanted to send a signal to North Korea after Kim Jong-un had his half-brother assassinated in Malaysia last week. His half-brother had strong ties to China and reportedly lived under Chinese protection, so that that assassination would have just enraged the Chinese. Those are all possible reasons why China would have, you know, wanted to punish North Korea with this coal ban. But China also has plenty of reasons to keep on supporting North Korea. China loves having this basket case nation just as sort of a distraction for China's own belligerent behavior. And then, of course, China really shares in all of North Korea's anti-Western ideologies. So it has many reasons to be an ally with it. But at this point, though, it looks like China could possibly be willing to back off on its North Korean support in order to present itself to the world as kind of a new global policeman. We have an article in the Trumpet Weekly this week. It's by Christopher Eames. I'll just read one short quote from it. He writes, "China is seeing an opportunity to become a new post-America world superpower and policeman. Yet, that means taking certain responsibilities with North Korea, such as cooperating with proposed UN sanctions against the nation." So there's a lot unknown. You know, China may have no real intentions of holding to this ban of North Korean coal. But if China does hold to the ban, then it could be a big step in Beijing presenting itself to the world as that new sort of global policeman and superpower.
Hmm. Well, thank you, Jeremiah. Efforts to resolve the civil war in Syria have been going on for quite some time, and among the nations involved in the effort are Iran and Turkey. You don't often see these two nations working together on anything, and the fact that they're involved in trying to bring peace to Syria should give you an idea of just how much success to expect in that endeavor. But this week, the animosity between these two rivals bubbled to the surface. To tell us about it and why it's important, we're going to go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
So as we speak, there's this meeting that's going on in Geneva to try and bring some type of peace to Syria. They've got the rebels there and they've got the regime there, and they're trying to hammer out a deal. Then, of course, you have the political nation, the nations supporting each of those sides. Iran and Russia, at least it looks like for now, supporting the regime in Syria. And then on the other side, you have the Turkey. Turkey is backing the rebels. And what we saw this week, because of the Syrian crisis is the Iranians and the Turks come to not physical blows, but at least verbal blows back and forth, actually over the past 2 weeks, involving how each of them are acting inside Syria. Now, going back for the last couple of decades, Iran and Turkey have kind of been at either end of the Middle East, and both of them hold on to great power inside the Middle East, and they have had warm relations between one another. Don't want it to they knew it wouldn't be good for the Middle East if they upset each other too much. And yet the Syrian civil war is starting to expose, crack at first, this relationship, and now it's becoming a giant chasm between the two. And just this week, or last couple of weeks, it started back on February 13, where Erdogan came out and singled out Iran while giving a speech in Bahrain. He said, quote, Erdogan being the president of Turkey, he said, "There are those who are working to divide Iraq. There is a sectarian ethnic struggle there because of the question of Persian nationalism." So Persia is obviously talking about Iran. He's saying there that the Persians are trying to ethnically separate Iraq, or divide it, or change the ethnic makeup of Iraq,
which is true.
And then which is true. That's what he said. And then Iran's foreign minister, he came out and accused Erdogan of being a sensationalist, and he accused Turkey of supporting terrorist groups, using them as a tool, I'm quoting now, and failing to respect the national sovereignty and territorial integrity of neighboring countries. And then he says that's been a cause for concern. So he's saying, Turkey, well, you're supporting the rebels. They're terrorists in Syria. So why are you interfering in another nation's affairs? So then the Turkish foreign minister,
Iran really has a position of they can pot kettle black.
Yeah. Honestly, I think both of these nations could call the other one out with exactly the same comments.
Right.
I think Turkey is awake to Iran. What started it all is that Turkey finally came clean and said what the world has noticed, or what we've been saying at least, is that Iran is trying to take over Iraq. Yeah. Iran is trying to take over Syria. And they finally came out and said something, and Iran comes out and says, oh, no, we're not. And then it went to the Munich Security Conference. This was last week. And you had both the Iranian foreign minister and the Turkish foreign minister there, not one after the other, but close enough. Both of them shouting at each other in those type of terms, saying, well, I can't believe what you're doing in the Middle East. And like I said in the intro, I mean, both these countries, they didn't come to these type of blows before because they need to preserve some type of relationship because it's mutually beneficial for them. Yeah. Now that we have seen Iran really try and take over and change the makeup of Syria and Iraq, Turkey's saying, I can't have it anymore. And, you know, this does really spell a definitive split in this relationship between Turkey and Iran.
Well, it probably gives you a sense of just how much Iran has advanced to the point where Turkey would feel like this type of discussion would be important to have. But it is something, just looking at it from the standpoint of biblical prophecy, we would have expected this at some point, just because we know that Turkey and Iran would be on opposite sides of the picture once everything shakes out.
Yeah, exactly. We did expect this, and that's why we're just drawing attention to it, because Bible prophecy does have these two huge nations on rival Middle East alliances. And this, as Mr. Gerald Flory wrote in that article back in 2011, 2012, about how the Syrian crisis will end, it will involve a great shakeup of the Middle East powers. And that's what we're seeing right now, these two alliances revealing themselves.
Thanks for that, Brent. There has been a lot of opposition to President Trump's immigration policies. Canada has expressed its disapproval by drawing the contrast to its own policy. This week, Canada's prime minister explained how Canada will handle those who come into the nation illegally. For this story, we're going to turn to Andrew Miller.
Yes, well, we talked earlier, I guess, how murder rates had tripled in Mexico, and it's, I guess it's the same number, immigration rates in January have tripled into Canada, being that normally there's the amount of illegal immigration into Canada seems pretty tame compared to illegal immigration to the United States. We have hundreds of thousands that pour into the United States every year, where the number in Canada is probably closer to a few thousand or maybe tens of thousands. But still, for the from whatever, I think the specific statistics said there were like some 400 people who illegally entered into Quebec last year. There's 400 people that illegally entered in Quebec this month, a triple the amount that entered in there the year before. Same in Manitoba and really across the border. And as you mentioned, the Canadian government has really taken a kind of what would seem a strange standpoint into this, and that they've pretty much just publicly stated that they're not going to do anything about this surge in illegal immigration. And Canada, just in generally, it's a very generous nation in terms of legal immigration. There's 30 million people who live there. They have legal processes for up to 300,000 people to immigrate there every year. They've legally accepted over 40,000 refugees from the Syrian civil war since it began. So they've already got a pretty generous refugee program, pretty generous legal immigration program. And yet now you're having multiple thousands of illegals pour over the border. And the prime minister has said he's not going to do anything about it.
And is he trying to draw this contrast with the United States, or saying like, look, if you may not be welcome in the United States, but Canada, we're a lot more generous than our southern neighbor.
Right. I think after President Donald Trump signed his executive order, instructing American immigration officials to actually enforce federal law, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau had sent out like a tweet on Twitter that said pretty much quote for quote exactly what you just said. He's like, says you may not be welcome in the United States, but immigrants are welcome in Canada. And definitely a number of people have taken him up on that and started crossing the border. It is interesting to look at the legality of it. I'm not as up on my knowledge of the Canadian Constitution as I am on the U.S. Constitution. And I know it's a little different there because it's not like America, where we have a Congress that makes the laws and then a president enforces those laws. The prime minister, he's kind of both in the legislative and executive branch simultaneously. So I'm not sure exactly what authority he has to just announce that he's not enforcing Canadian immigration law. Although if Parliament had a problem with it, they do have the authority to hold a no-confidence vote any time, which they haven't done. So it seems that both the Prime Minister and the majority of the Canadian Parliament seems fine with turning a blind eye to those who flaunt the immigration laws on the books up there.
The Trumpet actually has a bureau up in Canada with one of our writers who is a native Canadian, Tyrell Schlota. He has an article up on the Trumpet site right now on thetrumpet.com called Canada Hit with Surge of Illegal Immigrants. Actually, quite a lengthy analysis piece there. I'd encourage you to go online and to read that for more information on this story. We appreciate that, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Visit us at thetrumpet.com. We put all of the stories that we talk about on this program up in some form or other on the website. We try to collate as many of them together as we can and put them in the Trumpet Weekly. This is our weekly news report that we can send you for free every Friday, and you can get up to speed with the most important news from around the world. We're going to finish the program with our lightning round of important news, pack a few more headlines into the program before we finish. That's coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
We're going to finish the program with our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some headlines that caught our attention this past week, starting with Richard.
Germany is talking about economic retaliation against Donald Trump. We have an article in this week's Trumpet Weekly by Josue Michels pulling together various comments from different politicians, bureaucrats, newspapers, talking about how Germany and Europe are reviewing their options and looking at ways to hit back at Donald Trump. There's a trade war brewing, and we have an article coming up in the Trumpet print edition by Brad McDonald that talks more about this very important trend.
All right, we'll go now to Brent.
Iran's military budget for 2017 is the highest it's ever been under the radical Islamist regime that seized power in 1979. This year's budget will be reportedly $15.9 billion, up from 65%, well, up nearly 65% from 2014. Rouhani's government, that is the president of Iran, has recommended that nearly $25 billion, a quarter of the nation's budget, be allocated to various branches of the Iranian military and paramilitary groups. The largest group of this, the largest group receiving funds is the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. They report directly to the supreme leader of Iran. They're receiving $7 billion this year. The increase in cash for the military is due to the corresponding increase in the Iranian economy, a benefit of implementing the nuclear deal last year.
And now to Jeremiah.
Russia and China took another big step in military technical cooperation this week. They finalized a set of deals about China buying Russia's S-400 air defense systems, its anti-ship missile systems, and S-35 fighter aircraft. The Russian defense minister said it was a sign that Russian-Chinese military technical cooperation has been developing positively, and it looks like that positive development could pick up pace this year.
All right, now over to Andrew.
Australia has been plagued with wildfires, droughts, and floods in the past month. Severe flooding in Australia's Swan Valley wine country has been declared the worst in a century and a national emergency. The government's estimating lost wine revenues from inundated grape plants is going to cost the economy millions of dollars.
All right, we'll go back to Richard.
China is now Germany's top trading partner. It overtook the United States, who used to be in the number one spot. They're now in number three, with France in number two. So it shows this growing trade alliance now building between Europe and with China.
Back to Brent.
Iraqi forces officially launched the operation to take Mosul's western half on Sunday, with the Iraqi Regular Army and Federal Police taking part in the initial push. Since then, they have taken some 120 square kilometers, nearly 50 square miles, south of the city. And then on Thursday, they overtook the runway of Mosul's main airport from the Islamic State. Mosul, of course, is the last stronghold of the Islamic State inside Iraqi territory. And in January, Iraqi authorities announced that they had the eastern part of the city fully liberated, now onto the western part. It should be a couple of months before Islamic State is finally routed from Mosul and thus Iraq.
And over to Andrew.
United States President Donald Trump brought in a dozen of manufacturing CEOs to the White House this Thursday. They discussed efforts to bring back American manufacturing jobs from overseas back to the country. Though the CEOs told Mr. Trump that the main problem is that even though they have thousands of high-tech manufacturing jobs available, the American population lacks the skill set to perform the jobs that they need.
All right, and we'll finish with Jeremiah.
China is getting more religious. That's according to a new analysis published by Foreign Affairs this week, and it says that across China, hundreds of temples, churches, and mosques are opening every year, which are bringing in millions of new worshipers. The reason why seems to be connected to the rapid increase in the standard of living for the Chinese people. A Chinese pastor explained it as saying, quote, "We thought we were unhappy because we were poor. But now a lot of us aren't poor anymore, and yet we're still unhappy. We realize there's something missing, and that is a spiritual life."
Very interesting. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Visit thetrumpet.com. We'll give you a subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly, absolutely free. You can contact us and let us know what you think of the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Great to be having us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Emily Dickinson. Forever is composed of nows. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.